University professor Clarence Lussain and civil rights activist Larry Hamm, who served as co-chair of the Jesse Jackson presidential campaign in New Jersey in 1988. He was a Jackson delegate then and also a Bernie Sanders delegate in 2020. Stay with us.
Gonna lay down my sword and shield.
Down by the riverside.
Performing down by the riverside in our Firehouse studio more than 20 years ago. And we'll be celebrating our 30th anniversary February 23rd here in New York at the historic Riverside Church, where Dr. King gave his major speech opposing the war in Vietnam. To get tickets to this amazing event with Angela Davis and Naomi Klein, with Whit Marsalis and Michael Stipe, go to democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We're continuing our look at the life and legacy of the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who died today at the age of 84, a civil rights icon, two-time presidential candidate. We're joined now by two guests. Larry Hamm is a longtime civil rights activist. He's chair of the People's Organization for Progress. He was co-chair of the Jackson for President campaign in New Jersey in 1988. Also a Jackson delegate at the Democratic National Convention then, and the former resident of president of the New Jersey chapter of the Rainbow Coalition. And we're joined by Clarence Lussain, political science professor at Howard University, the director of the International Affairs Program there. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Clarence Lussain, let's begin with you. You woke up this morning with this news of this historic figure having passed, the Reverend Jesse Jackson. Your thoughts on his significance, on his life and legacy.
Good morning, Amy, and good morning, Larry, as well. Yeah, my phone has been blowing up with texts from not just people here in the U.S., but from around the world as the news spread. I want to echo what Bernie Sanders said about Jackson's contribution. Jackson's life contributed to making this country more democratic, more inclusive, more fair. What Jackson was able to do was to marry movements, grassroots movements, with electoral politics. Prior to the 1980s, a lot of activists who were working on issues from anti-nuclear kinds of concerns to peace issues to civil rights had a kind of sketchy relationship with electoral politics. And Jackson saw that that was a vehicle for being able to bring this country to its principles that it espouses. And so in 84 and in 88, Jackson was doing two things. One was building an electoral movement that would make the Democratic Party and electoral politics more democratic. But at the same time, he was also building a movement outside of that, the National Rainbow Coalition, which picked up the mantle from the civil rights movement and from what Dr. King and others had been doing in the 1960s and brought that into the 1980s and beyond. And his contributions were not just domestic, of course, but also international, not only working with folks who were working around issues like human rights and peace, but just a range of concerns that people had around the world, including, of course, the anti-apartheid movement.
And talk about that, especially for young people who aren't so familiar with the movement to take down apartheid in South Africa. And going back to 1966, the March Against Fear in Mississippi. Oh, up through, what was it, 2000, with the fight around Gore and Bush.
Yep, the 1966 March Against Fear happened in Mississippi. This was 3 years after King had given his speech at the March on Washington, I Have a Dream speech, and Medgar Evers had been killed, and James Meredith, who was a local activist in Mississippi, started a march. He was shot during that march, but that then galvanized the entire civil rights movement to come to Mississippi. So Jackson was there, King was there, Stokely Carmichael was there. That's where Stokely Carmichael made his famous statement about Black power. And that's important because what we see with Jackson is that he brought together the disparate parts of not only the Black political movement, people who were nationalists, people who consider themselves socialists, people who consider themselves liberals, even Black conservatives. Jackson would galvanize and rally and when he ran in 88 and 84. But Jackson also brought together people outside of the civil rights community and outside of the Black community. And so that was really kind of a turning point. So then we get to 1983, and there's a big celebration of the 20th anniversary of the March on Washington. But it's also a protest against Reagan. Reagan had been elected in 1980 and launched the harshest anti-civil rights presidency to that date. And so Jackson and civil rights leaders and trade unions and others called for this march. And at that march, there was a grassroots, there had been a grassroots movement growing, and it swelled, Run, Jesse, Run. So this wasn't Jackson just saying, I want to be president. This was a recognition of Jackson's work, his moral and political clarity in that moment. And he launched not only his presidential campaign, which many of us worked on, and Larry was critical in that, Ron Daniels, Jack O'Dell, others. But he also launched the National Rainbow Coalition, and they worked in parallel. And as Bernie said and others have noted, the reason Barack Obama becomes president in 2008 is because of the work that Jackson and others like Fannie Lou Hamer, who made sure that the Democratic Party would democratize and change the rules of the game so that when Obama ran in 2008, he was running under very different circumstances than even when Jackson ran in 1984 and 1988. And Jackson continued that inside-outside strategy pretty much all of his life. He was active around the Gore v. Bush controversy, for example, where in 2000, when Gore ran against Bush, and essentially Florida stole the election, there was a suit, and the Clarence Thomas and others on the Supreme Court basically gave the election to the Electoral College to George W. Bush. Jackson was one of the people out in the street who was organizing and mobilizing around that movement. So he never kind of gave up at any point along the way. And again, just really quickly on the anti-apartheid movement, for decades, the South African white minority held the Black majority under severe segregation. And there had been a global movement to bring down that government. Jackson was a central voice in this country consistently on raising that issue. And then when finally Mandela was released from prison, Nelson Mandela, who's the leader of the African National Congress, Jackson was there. And after Mandela became president, Jackson continued to support a new South Africa and a more democratic South Africa. So it's really important, as you note, that this is taught. And at Howard University, we certainly include Jackson in our courses on Black politics and in other areas.
Well, I want to thank you, Clarence Lussain, for being with us, political science professor at Howard University, director of the International Affairs Program. His books include $20 and Change, Harriet Tubman, and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice and Democracy, and the Black History of the White House. He talked about Professor Clarence Lussain, Larry. That's Larry Hamm, civil rights activist, chairman of the People's Organization for Progress, co-chair of the Jackson for President campaign in New Jersey in 1988, also a Jackson delegate at the Democratic Convention in 1988, and former president of New Jersey chapter of Rainbow Coalition. I wanted to go to a clip of Reverend Jackson speaking again when he ran for president in 1988. We're showing an old clip of you, Larry, holding up a poster that says Jesse! Exclamation point Jesse, and your yellow T-shirt says Jersey Jesse. Let's go to a clip.
We must never surrender. America will get better and better. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive. Keep hope alive.
Keep hope alive. That was the phrase before hope, that remarkable picture with Barack Obama. Yes. But you go way back. Go back to 1971, Larry.
Well, that was my first contact with Jesse Jackson in 1971. I had been invited to the SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference National Convention in New Orleans to receive an award. I had just been appointed to the Board of Education in Newark by Ken Gibson, the first Black mayor of Newark.
And you were the youngest ever member of the Board of Education.
Yes, yes.
You would later become known as Edimu, and you were a protege of Amiri Baraka.
That is correct. And I was invited down by Coretta Scott King, and I met many of the civil rights leaders that were still living at that time, including Jesse Jackson. In fact, that was my first introduction to his oratorical powers. He spoke one night for almost like 3 hours, I think, at the dinner. And then again, we crossed paths at the National Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana in 1972. And Jesse gave one of his most famous speeches at the opening of the National Black Political Convention in Gary in 1972. But then, as you mentioned, Amy, in 1984, he ran for president. At that time, we had formed in Newark the People's Organization for Progress in 1982. But in 84, we formed another group called Friends of Jesse Jackson to campaign for Jesse and to raise money for him. And then in 88, everything came together in the 1988 campaign. I was co-chair of his campaign in New Jersey and a Jesse Jackson delegate. And I want to say one of the major impacts that Jesse had, and I remember this fight pretty clearly, was the question of winner take all versus proportional representation. At the convention, you were selected to be the presidential nominee based on the number of delegates you won. And if you won a district, you got all the delegates. Jesse Jackson helped change that. So it was proportional. You got the number of delegates in proportion to the number of votes you received. And I think that that mechanistically was one of the things that helped pave the way, as Bernie Sanders and Professor Lussain mentioned, paved the way for Barack Obama to become president. Jesse Jackson, in that way, made the democratic process, as Jesse said, more democratic.
So talk about the significance, I mean, the inspiration for the next generations. I mean, you had Jackson taking on the large corporations, very comfortable walking into Wall Street, demanding proportional representation, not only in voting, but based on, for example, in media outlets around the country, proportional representations to the population they broadcast to, to have African-American reporters there, launched many young Black reporters in the country being hired.
Right. Well, he introduced that principle not only into the political sphere, but into the economic sphere, that black people, as you said, in the media should have representation proportional to our presence in the population, should have contracts and business in proportion to our population. That was one of his mantras at that time. But what amazes me, Amy, looking at the clips you played here this morning, is how prescient, how relevant Jackson's message was in the 80s and 90s to today. I mean, he's talking basically about the same thing, you know, that we're living under political tyranny, economic tyranny of Wall Street, the greatest upward distribution of wealth in the history of the country, increasing poverty and unemployment. And we need a fundamental change. And I think those of us who recognize Reverend Jackson's contributions, the way we continue to honor him is to step up, intensify the struggle for racial and economic justice in this country.
Finally, you ran for various political offices in New Jersey. You were there at the convention. In 1988, he got the second greatest number of votes for the presidential nomination. He famously was there in the crowd in Chicago when Barack Obama had just been elected, and you saw his tear-stained face as he looked up into the crowd.
Right.
Your final thoughts on Reverend Jesse Jackson?
Well, he was our living link to the civil rights movement, the black freedom struggle, the black liberation movement. Jesse Jackson, more than anything else, was audacious. If he had waited around for people to say, Jesse, you should run for president, or Jesse, you should do this, it probably wouldn't have happened. Jesse knew his place in history. He knew because of his role in the civil rights movement. And that's something we should not overlook. We talk more about the contemporary Jesse Jackson. We need to talk about his role in that movement of blood and fury in the 1960s, the civil rights movement in which so many lives were taken. But as I said, the best way that we can honor Jesse Jackson and all the martyrs, we also saw this week, a couple of weeks, the passage of Claudette Colvin, is to get back, step
Claudette
up.
Claudette Colvin was Rosa Parks before Rosa Parks sat down on the bus and refused to get out.
Jesse's daughter, Santita, spoke at the tribute at Abyssinian Baptist Church last week. I was also there for that. But the best way that we can honor these people is to step up this fight, because Jesse's life was an arc, and we saw that arc move in the direction of progress, and now the arc swings in the opposite direction of really counter-revolution, and now we have to step up and build this movement to fight that.
Let's end with Reverend Jesse Jackson in his own words in 2013 at the 40th anniversary of the March on Washington.
And so keep dreaming of the constitutional right to vote. Stop the madness in North Carolina and Texas. Keep dreaming. Keep dreaming. Revive the war on poverty. Keep dreaming. To go from stopping frisk to stopping employ, stopping educate, stopping house, stopping choose schools over jails. Keep dreaming. Keep dreaming student loan debt forgiveness as a stimulus. Keep dreaming. Revive the U.S. Civil Rights Commission with the conscience of our nation. Keep dreaming. Restore foreclosed housing. Keep dreaming. Comprehensive immigration reform that includes Africa, Haiti, and the Caribbean. Keep dreaming. 50 years later, we are free but not equal. Keep dreaming. Choose life over death. Futures over funerals, and more graduation than less funerals. And so keep the faith, and through it all, keep hope alive.
That's the Reverend Jesse Jackson on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Reverend Jackson died earlier this morning at the age of 84 at his home, surrounded by family. I want to thank Larry Hamm, civil rights activist, chair of the People's Organization for Progress, co-chair of the Jackson for President campaign in New Jersey in 88 and a Jackson delegate in 1988. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Minneapolis to Look at ICE and the Justice Department. Two federal immigration officers lied under oath about an attack in Minneapolis involving two Venezuelan immigrants shot by an ICE agent. Stay with us. Performing down by the riverside in our firehouse studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Minnesota, two ICE agents have been suspended and face criminal investigation into whether they lied to a jury about the shooting of a Venezuelan immigrant last month. The officers claimed Julio Cesar Sosa Celis and his cousin Alfredo Alejandro Aljorno attacked them with a snow shovel and a broom after a traffic stop on January 14th and said one of the officers fired in self-defense. Shortly after the shooting, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem described it as an attempted murder of federal law enforcement. But video evidence directly contradicts claims the men attacked federal agents. Sosa Celis said he'd retreated into his home and was shot in the leg while in the process of closing and locking his door. On Thursday, a federal judge dismissed felony assault charges against the cousins after the U.S. attorney in Minneapolis said newly discovered evidence had contradicted the officer's testimony and after ICE admitted the federal agents lied under oath. For more, we're joined in Minneapolis by Frederick Getz, criminal defense attorney who represents Alfredo Alejandro Aljorno. Thanks so much for being with us. Can you explain exactly what happened? How rare for the Department of Justice to admit that their agents lied?
Well, that is unusual, as is the result in this case, which is not only a dismissal, but a dismissal with prejudice, meaning that my client can never be charged again for anything to do with this incident.
Explain what took place as you understand it, Fred Getz.
What happened from my client's perspective, which I think is actually the truthful version, is that he was on his way home. He's a DoorDash delivery person, and he was followed by ICE agents. This followed the shooting of Renee Goodbye about a week, so he was filled with fear. He just wanted to get home. He gets out of his car, and he's running in his home when he's tackled by the ICE agent. At that point, there is a struggle. There's no dispute about that. My client slipped out of his sweater and then was in the process of running into his home. His cousin comes out, Juan Sosa Celis, or Julio Sosa Celis. They do not strike the agent. There's no attack with a broom. There's no attack with a shovel. They run and retreat inside the house behind a closed door, and that's when they're shot at by the agent.
If you can explain what they were originally charged with.
They were charged with assaulting a federal officer, which is a very serious offense. As a result of this, Mr. Aljorno, I mean, he's been branded a criminal, not only here, but, you know, through the internet in his home of Venezuela. And so this person who'd been living a law-abiding life up to this point is all of a sudden deemed a criminal. So it's had serious repercussions for this man and his reputation.
Can you talk about the significance of the judge dismissing the case with prejudice? What does with prejudice mean?
It means he can never be charged again for anything to do related with this. And I should point out that the judge granted the government's motion. So it was the government's moving to dismiss the case with prejudice that then gave the judge the opportunity to grant that relief. And the government should be commended for taking that bold and affirmative step in recognizing the wrong and making concrete efforts to correct it.
Can you explain where your client, Alfredo Alejandro Aljona, one of the two Venezuelan men, and Julio Cesar Sosa Celis are right now?
They've returned to their families in Minnesota.
And to have ICE issuing a statement admitting its federal agents made false statements under oath, admitting that their agents lied. Explain what's now happened to them.
There's ongoing investigations on both the state and the federal level, but I think it shows the importance of following the facts rather than following the story. The story came out early on. The story was wrong, and it's heartening to see that the facts prevail. This is one case, and I don't know if it's message of things to come. We hope so. But in this one case, I'm confident justice has been served so far.
Why haven't the agents been publicly identified?
That's a question you'll have to ask ICE officials.
So they're on administrative leave. To explain what you expect to happen now with this investigation.
Well, there's two parallel investigations. There's an investigation by local authorities, state and local authorities, and there's an investigation by federal authorities. Those will both proceed at pace. I don't know, and you alluded to it in different contexts, the extent of coordination, if any, between those investigations. Before Operation Metro Surge, there was typically coordination between state and federal authorities in these type of cases, not this case.
Can you talk about the trauma of your client and his cousin?
They had different traumas, of course. Mr. Sosa Celis was shot physically, so that's an extra dimension to it. With my client, it's the trauma of being branded and internationally a criminal. This is somebody who violently attacked a federal officer. That never happened. And my client is doing the best he can to show that he's just the law-abiding person he's always been.
What connection do you see between their case and what Trump officials said about Rene Good and Alex Preti?
The connection is this. As I said before, you follow the facts, not the story. And in this case, ultimately, the facts prevailed over the story. The story was what was perpetrated the first few days or promulgated the first few days. But I think the danger is getting the story ahead of the facts, because here the story was shown to be false.
And so how is Mr. Celis Sosa since he's been shot by ICE agents?
Well, he's not my client. I represent Mr. Aljona. But I understand all of the, in this case, Mr. Horner, Mr. Sosa Celis, they're all back home with their families.
That's Mr. Sosa Celis. Thanks so much for being with us. Frederick Goetz, criminal defense attorney who represents Alfredo Alejandro Aljona, one of the two Venezuelan men who were falsely accused of assaulting a federal immigration agent in Minneapolis in January. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Neil Shabata. On Monday, February 23rd, Democracy Now! Will be celebrating our 30th anniversary at the historic Riverside Church in New York. Guests will include Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, Vaclav Abutoha, the Nobel Prize-winning journalist, Maria Ressa, the singer and songwriter Michael Stipe, the jazz legend Wynton Marsalis, the formerly known as Eve Ensler, Hooray for the Riff Raff, and so many more. Juan Gonzalez will be flying in from Chicago, joining me and Nermeen Sheikh and our whole Democracy Now! Family for the celebration. Check out democracynow.org for information and tickets. I'm Amy Goodman.
You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
CJS